Good evening. Tonight's lecture is entitled The Golden Age of Spain. We discussed last lecture Rav Sadegon, the personality, Rav Sadegon, the individual who took on the Karaites and was really the first one who successfully put them in their place, and that was really the beginning of the end of the Karaites. With the death of Rav Sadegon in 942 of the Common Era, the period of the Gaonim of Babylonia was almost over. It would officially end in 1038. The great period, which we call the period of the Gaonim of Babylonian Jewry, ends with the death of Rav Haigon in 1038. By 1038, many Jews had left what was formerly had 80 to 90% of world Jewry for hundreds of years. The Babylonian Empire, which was eventually, after the Sassanids, conquered by the Muslims. And they had moved into North Africa and begun to move into Europe. What were the reasons for the change of events in Babylonia? The change of events, why Babylonian Jewry started its decline and ended very quickly from its preeminent status amongst the Jewish people. First and foremost is that Babylonia was always the center for hundreds of years, from the time of almost the destruction of the Second Temple to approximately 1,000 years later. It was the center of Torah study. The reason why Babylonia was so important was because of the great yeshivas, which we had discussed previously, of Sura, of Pumpedisia. These yeshivas had thousands of students, and Jews throughout the ancient world would send their queries to these yeshivas, would ask questions to these yeshivas. Moreover, besides the decline of these yeshivas, the economic world, the world of commerce, the world of trade, by the 9th, 10th century had left the Middle East and really had moved towards Europe. The world of commerce, the new opportunities, trade, the place of great trade became Europe. And Jewish being involved in trade is not a new thing. The Jews went where the money is. And Jews started to follow. You know, it's unbelievable. With the 49ers, came the Jews to San Francisco, came the Jews to California. The Jews were traveling along to figure out where they can trade, where they can be involved in business. And Iraq, Babylonia, really, by the 10th century, was not the same, not the same prominence, mostly because of civil wars, but also because of the new realities of the world, that Christian Europe became a little bit more developed. And the Muslims had a foothold in Europe, and believe it or not, even though the Muslims were constantly fighting with the Christians, at the same time, they were trading with the Christians. Since the Muslims had entered Europe, there was a tremendous overlap of trade. The Jews were always the best intermediaries for that trade, because Jews were able to speak the same language wherever they went, and they had common ground wherever they went. So the bridge between the Muslims and the Christians in Europe would be the Jews. So the Jews would start to go to those areas, and we'll see soon Spain will become first and foremost, where the Muslim world would meet the Christian world because of trade, as well as we'll see, that these areas become centers of Torah. So due to the economy, heavy taxation by the Arabs, as we mentioned the two lectures ago, the Arabs had a special tax on Jews called jizya, which made it more difficult to make a living. Jews went into trade and they started to go throughout the world. But before that, there were two great sages. The first was Rav Haigon. Anyone who studies the Talmud, Jewish law, has heard of Rav Haigon. Rav Haigon lived from 939 to 1038. That's 99 years. He made 99 years, 1,000 years ago. That's a long life for 1,000 years ago. He lived from 939 to 1038. He was the last of the great Gaonim of Pumpedisia. Rav Haigon had good genetics, because his father was the Rosh Hashiva of Pumpadisa as well. And he took over for his father. But not only did he have good genetics from the mental standpoint and the nurture standpoint, but his father lives to 98 years. So, Rav Shrira Gaon, who was famous for giving a list of all the sages going back to Moshe and showing how the Torah was passed from generation to generation, Rav Shrira was Rav Hai's teacher. Rav Shrira lived to 98 years old. When Rav Hai Gaon was 48 years old, he became the second in command of the yeshiva in Pumbedisya. 48 years old, he became the Av Beis Din, which means the head of the Beis Din. Rav Shrira Gaon was the Rosh Hashiva. Rav Hai Gaon was the Av Beis Din. Now, as mentioned, you have to imagine what Pumbedisya was like. Pumbedisya was like this great center of learning, with hundreds of times thousands of students studying there. And literally questions from throughout the world, even in Rav Hai Gaon's time, he'll be getting questions from Spain, from Morocco, certainly from closer places like the Persian Empire, and Egypt, and Israel, but throughout the world, from ancient France. In today's world, you imagine, you know, people ask some of the sages in Israel, a Sephardic Rav will ask Rav Avadia Yosef in Israel. So, Rav Avadia Yosef doesn't have email, he'll call somebody to get to Rav Avadia Yosef. But in those days, if you're asking from Spain to Babylon, it took months, and yet Rav Hai Gaon was the center of all of these questions. That's why Rav Hai Gaon would eventually be called the last of the Gaonim, but first in importance. He had authority throughout the ancient world. Now, at the end of his father, Rav Shrira Gaon's life, an event happened that shook them both up. They were accused falsely by the Caliph of Baghdad of treason. In those days, if you're accused of treason by the Caliph of Baghdad, you wouldn't buy life insurance. No one would sell it to you. It didn't look too good for Rav Shrira. Eventually, they were acquitted. But really, Rav Shrira was an elderly man at the time. He was at the end of his life. And he said he wanted to give over the rulership to his son. So in his lifetime, Rav Shrira appointed Rav Hai Gaon as the next Rosh Hashiva of Pumbedisya. And they said that they read the Haftorah that week. There's the Haftorah, of course, Shlomo Salman became the king of all of Israel in David's lifetime. So they read that Haftorah, and instead of saying, and Shlomo sat on the throne in the life of David, it said, and Hai sat on the throne in the life of Shrira. So he actually took over as Rosh Hashiva in his lifetime. Rav Hai Gaon wrote numerous works, some of which we have today, many of what we do not. He wrote Shari Shavuos, or Mishpat Shavuos, which is on the laws of oaths. He wrote Sefer Mekach HaMemkar, which is on the laws of purchases. The fact these books are so advanced at the time, you know, when most of the ancient world had no laws on dealing on transactions and purchases, the Jewish people had extremely technical, advanced laws. What happens? Buyer's rights, seller's rights, purchaser's rights, who had, at what point is the contract fulfilled? At what time, at what point could you go back on the contract? Here laws on Isser V'Heter, things on Shechita, on all of Tanakh, Mishnah, and Gemara. He also wrote many Piyutim, and if you look at, in the literature, his contemporaries and generations after, Rav Hai Gaon is called Rabban Shal Yisrael, the teacher of all of Israel. And he was the last Yeshiva of Pumbedisya. His father-in-law, who, since he lived for 99 years, was almost like, it was his same age. His father-in-law was the same age as him. Rav Shmuel Bar Chofni was the Rosh Hashiva of Sura, the other great Rosh Hashiva, the other great yeshiva in Babylonia. And Rav Shmuel Bar Chofni lived from 969 to 1034. His father was the chief rabbi of Fez, in Morocco. And Rav Shmuel Bar Chofni wrote extensively as well. We have nothing left of his. You have to remember this is the ancient world. He wrote in Arabic, firstly, or in Arabic because that was the language of the masses. And if it was written in Arabic, if it wasn't translated, it didn't stand the test of time. One work which passed down was his introduction to Talmud, which was 150 chapters. So a small part of it was taken by Shmuel HaNagid, who we'll speak of soon, and that was still in existence. But Shmuel Bar Kofni dies a couple years before his son-in-law, and with the death of both Rav Shmuel Bar Kofni and Rav Haigon, the end of Babylonian Jewry comes. Really, with their deaths, the yeshivas never really stick around. Sura and Pumbedisya, these yeshivas which were around for 800 years, are pretty much dissipate and are gone with history. And the remarkable thing is here you had a golden chain of tradition. You had sages, Tanayim, Amorayim, the sages of the Talmud, Gaonim for hundreds and hundreds of years. And within a generation or two, it disappears due to numerous factors. But yet, the study of Torah continued to flourish without a break. And moved, we'll see in a minute, to Spain and to North Africa and to Egypt. And this, of course, is a remarkable thing in Jewish history. Here you had Babylonian Jews. You know, there's a Daf Yomi every morning in the shul. People ask, what about the Babylonian Jewry? I mean, there will be Jews in Iraq till 1948. There was a significant population. But Iraq would not be the center of the Torah world anymore. Okay, even the time of the Ben Ish Chai, who was a great Rav, it was nowhere comparable to other centers of Torah. You had a great rabbi here or there, but it was not where the yeshivas were. It was not the center of learning. It would leave Jewish history. So you would imagine with the demolition of Babylonian Jewry, it would have been a tremendous setback to the Jewish people. But the Torah says that the Torah will never leave the mouths of the Jews. And as Babylonian Jewry comes, kind of like with the end of the Holocaust, you can imagine with all these Lithuanian and Polish yeshivas slammed shut by the Nazis, if you were a sociologist, you would say, this is it. And here in America and in Eretz Yisrael today, you have yeshivas of thousands of students. Hey, when one candle is extinguished, another candle is lit. And that's really what happens. How does the Torah leave Babylonia and spread to the rest of the world? There is a story. And this is recorded already in the 12th century by the Ravid, Avram Ibn Dawud, who I spoke about the last class in the Sefer Kabbalah. He brings the following story, which is recorded in other works as well. And that is that the story of the four captives. I'm not sure if anyone heard the story. It's a famous story. I learned it as a little boy in school. But it's a story of the four captives. Some people say it didn't have exactly the way it is, just more, an illustration. But there's no question, to a large extent, this is what happened because it's historically backed by many, many other sources. And that is in approximately the year 1000 of the Common Era. A ship left Italy to go from the city of Bari in Italy in order to sail together to a different city in the Mediterranean where a mutual friend was getting married. And there were four great rabbis on the ship. Their names were Rabbi Shmaraya, Rabbi Hushiel, Rabbi Moshe ben Enoch, Rabbi Moshe ben Enoch, who had his wife and his son Enoch on the ship. And the fourth rabbi we don't know. Now, in those days, the seas, especially the Mediterranean, were infested by pirates, whose business was it to steal ships. Now, Muslims historically, you know, we think today, who are the famous pirates? Somalia. You read if you look at the news, every once in a while they're pulling not only small ships off the Horn of Africa or near Africa, they're pulling American ships, European ships, like cargo ships, humongous cargo ships. They're pirating these ships. We know that America, the United States, went to war. The first war that this country went, most people don't know American history, but it was in 1801, 1803, was the war against the Barbary pirates. After the first war, after the war, the American Revolution, was not the war of 1812 against Britain, but was a war against Barbary pirates. Who was the Barbary pirates? These were Muslim pirates from Tunisia, from Northern Africa, Morocco, Algeria areas, who were stealing American ships. And the minute Britain had taken off their protection from American ships, because until that point, America was under English protection. American ships were under attack. So America went to war under John Adams to protect their ships. Well, the Muslims have a long history of pirates. They don't have a monopoly on piracy, just like they don't have a monopoly on terrorism, but they certainly were very active in terrorism and in piracy. If you look back, even in the 9th century, people will be amazed at what the Muslims did with their piracy. In 846 of the Common Era, the Muslim raiders, pirates, got off into Rome and literally sacked the Vatican. Right, you imagine today the Vatican was bombed. The Muslim pirates used to terrorize the Mediterranean basin. They got off, they stole ships. One time they actually got out, sacked Rome, and went to the Vatican and sacked the Vatican as well. In 911, Muslim pirates took over an area called Fraxinet, in a fortress in Provence, which is southern France, and they shut all passes to the Alps. And so much so that the Bishop of Narbonne was unable to return to France from Rome. Muslim pirates used all the Balearic Islands throughout the 10th century, Majorca, Menorca, all those islands. From 824 to 961, Arab pirates, Muslim pirates, ruled Crete and also terrorized the whole Mediterranean. Venice at one point had to get involved to protect the fleets. They were all over the Mediterranean. This was a fact of life in the Middle Ages of Muslim pirates. Well, these four rabbis, their ship was stolen by one of the fiercest pirates of the 11th century, and that was Ibn Rumas. And he took over the ship. Now, he looks around the ship, he gets on the ship, the rabbi says, and he sees four rabbis with white beards. Now, you may think, oh, four rabbis with white beards, those are great, maybe get a blessing. You have holy people on the ship. He didn't think that at all. He saw four rabbis, white beards, around the 1,000 Common Era. He saw green dollar bills. He said, cha-ching, I just did really well over here. We're going to sell these people to the Jews. Because they'll ransom. He knew the Jews would ransom. Jews, of course, Pinyan Shvum, would ransom their own. And he got four sages. And so Ibn Ahmas went ahead and made a lot of money. And the first community he ransomed in them to, he went to Alexandria, Egypt, and he offered Rabbi Shmaraya for sale. He requested a huge ransom, and the Jews of Alexandria paid the ransom for Rabbi Shmaraya. He basically looted Alexandria. Rabbi Shmaraya didn't stay in Alexandria because that was a weaker city at that time. We know historically, we've spoken about previously, it was a huge Jewish city, but he went to Fostat. Fostat is old Cairo. Eventually, Rambam Maimonides would live in Fostat. That's because by the time Maimonides got there, Fostat was a developed area. Rabbi Shmaraya moves to Fostat. He becomes the chief rabbi of Cairo and of Egyptian Jewry and builds a yeshiva there. He did not want to go back onto a boat ever in his life. So there was no going back to Italy. It's a question, were they originally from Babylonia or from Italy? But, you know, if you've already been kidnapped on the seas, basically wherever they got ransomed, they stayed. Because you're traumatized. It's not, you know, imagine being kidnapped by the arch pirate of the day. So he stayed and became the rabbi of Fostat. He builds a yeshiva there, and so begins a Torah center in Fostat. The next place that Ibn Rumas went was Karyuan. Karyuan, most even North African Jews have never heard of it. In fact, I tested this theory just before. I went to Mrs. Simon, who grew up in Casablanca. I said, "Have you ever heard of Karyuan?" She said, "What's that?" I said, "You never heard of it? It's one of the greatest Jewish centers of Torah ever." It was a city in Tunisia, which for hundreds of years had lived from the greatest sages. The next city where he went was Karyuan, where he sold Rabbi Chushiel. Rabbi Chushiel was also a great scholar. Of course, every city he went to, because he knew he could get a high, the first sale was always a huge price. And he had no problem. He just went from Jewish center to Jewish center. At the time, these were mercantile centers and not Torah centers. He went to Karyuan, he sold Rabbeinu Chushiel. Rabbeinu Chushiel did the same thing. He opened the yeshiva. In fact, one of his students, and this is how we know the story, it corroborates the story, because he also brings this down, one of Rabbi Chushiel's students is Rabbeinu Hananel. Anybody who studies the Talmud knows that on every folio of Talmud, on right next to the Talmud, is Rabbeinu Hananel. He is a student of this Rabbi Chushiel. He lived in Tunisia, in Kairouan, Tunisia. Rabbeinu Nissim, not the Ran, which we'll speak about later, one of the great Rabbeinu Nissim Goyin, it's called, he was also a student of Rabbi Chushiel, who was in Kairouan. On went Ibn Nachman to Spain. Now Spain at the time, and we'll speak about Spain at length soon, started to have a very large population of Jews. As mentioned, because Spain was at the crossroads of Islam and Christianity, and Jews were trading between the two. Spain, as we'll also see, would have relatively moderate Moors, Berbers, who ruled the country, who were generally tolerant of Jews in a world of general intolerance. To Spain, Ibn Rahmas sold Ramesha. But before he did that, on the way to Spain, because it was a large trip to Spain, he started to observe Rabbeinu Moshe's wife. And she was a very fair, light-skinned, attractive lady. And he tried to seduce her. And he said, leave this rabbi, come with me, sail the seas, and live a good life. And he starts promising that I won't kill you, I won't sell you, I won't, you'll gain, I'll give you wealth. And she spoke to her, now they speak in Arabic, she asks her husband, Ramesh, if I jump off the sea, will I come around alive in the resurrection of the dead? And he said, yes. She jumped into the sea and committed suicide. Okay, now of course Ramesh and his son was on the boat, Enoch, were petrified and mourned tremendously. But it brings down, at some level they felt that their mother sanctified the name of God, and they were comforted by that. Rabbeinu Moshe was sold to Cordova. And when he was sold, nobody recognized who he was as a sage. It was not really a learned place at the time, Spain. And even Moshe went ahead, he was called the captive. He wasn't known as a scholar, or as a sage. He was called the captive. The one who was freed. The freed captive. One day, he was listening to a shiur by Rav Nosson, Rabbi Nathan, who was the head of the chief rabbi of Cordova. And he corrected Rabbi Nathan after the class. He said, by the way, I think this is really the halacha. And he got to a discussion, and Moshe told him the halacha and explained to the halacha. When Rabbi Nosson heard this, he said, I can no longer be the chief rabbi of Cordova, which is, as we spoke about last time, which at the time was the greatest city in Spain. I have to be the son of Moshe. And he pushed Moshe, and Moshe ended up being the chief rabbi of Spain. And this is how Spanish Jewry begins its Torah study, which is a remarkable thing, because this is greatness in Torah. If you always look, Hillel, the same thing happened with Hillel. Hillel was not on the Beis Din, but when they stepped down in order to put him on because of a different diet, he's even greater. That's true Torah. It's not that I'm in power. Can you imagine Obama saying, ooh, I think this guy's better than me. He should be the president of the United States. No, it's not legal in this country. But can you imagine any leader, not Obama, I don't care, Republican, Democrat, British, Canadian, can you imagine any leader saying, well, I think they're more competent than me? I went to think, can you imagine Joseph Stalin saying, ooh, Trotsky, you take over? No, I don't think so. You have to imagine, that is Torah study, it's an appreciation. It's not a question of me, it's a question of what's the best for this community. He puts Ramesha in charge. Ramesha, and we'll discuss it shortly again, was the generation of Chastai. We spoke about Chastai Ibn Shaprut last week, 2 weeks ago. And that's how Cordova became the city of Torah of the generation, because Ramesha came and built a yeshiva, and the remarkable thing is, and that's how Torah spread out of Babylonia. Wherever they went, they will build a yeshiva, because if you only have rabbis and you don't have Jewish education, you don't have a future. So the way it is, if kids can't learn, if Torah is not studied, just going to services is not enough. The reason that Torah spread is because all these sages, wherever they went, they started places of study. Places of study. When Ramesha came to Spain, Jews had been there for generations. In fact, the history of Spanish Jewry dates back at least 2,000 years to the Roman rule, approximately ready 205 BCE, there are archaeological evidence of Jews in Spain. And we don't know that much about what Jews did in Spain. We know that Jews were involved in trade in Spain at the time of the Romans. We don't know that much. The first time that we really learn a little bit about the Jews in Spain is in the year 303. And how do we learn about the Jews in Spain in 303? Well, that's because by that time there's a tremendous Christian presence in Spain, and they already had their first anti-Jewish decrees. And that was called the Council of Elvira. And look at source number one, because you'll get a little bit of an understanding of the Jews in Spain based on source number one. There were 80 canons in this Council of Elvira. Source number one. Canon number 16. Heretics shall not be joined in marriage with Catholic girls unless they accept the Catholic faith. Catholic girls may not marry Jews or heretics because they cannot find a unity when faithful and the unfaithful are joined. Parents who allow this to happen shall not commune for 5 years, which basically was the equivalent of complete ostracism in that community. You would be ostracized if a Jew married a Catholic, which I am not upset about, by the way. But in their own minds, it was an anti-Semitic decree. Luke number 49. This is remarkable. They actually have to have a canon on this. Landlords are not to allow Jews to bless the crops they have received from God and from which they offer thanks. Such an action would make our blessing invalid and meaningless. Anyone who continues this practice is to be expelled completely from the church. Apparently, the land people would ask the Jews, bless my land. In fact, I heard of Gifters at Saul say that when he was in Tells in Lithuania, the Lithuanian peasants would stop the yeshiva boys, bring them to their fields, and say, bless my fields. This was even after all the Catholic laws. You can see the late third century, beginning of the fourth, that it was common practice to ask a Jew to bless the land, which they came to ban, because of course it gave the Jews more than legitimacy. Number 50. If any cleric or layperson eats with a Jew, now that's already a far off, you can't even eat with a Jew, he or she shall be kept from communion as a way of correction. 78 is also, although anti-Semitic in their own idea, as far as Jewish law, it's not a bad thing. If a Christian confesses adultery with a Jewish or pagan woman, he is denied communion for some time. If his sin is exposed by someone else, he must complete 5 years penance before receiving the Sunday communion. Well, these were all canons to separate the Christians from the Jews. Not necessarily hurting the Jews, but separation. But that would change. In the 5th century, the Visigoths, who were much more famous for sacking Rome, the Visigoths, well, they were Arian Christians. Now, when we discuss Christianity, I discuss the difference between Nicenean Christianity and Arian Christianity. Arian Christians believed that Jesus was a man, kind of like Islam, that Jesus was a man who had prophecy from God, whereas the Nicenean Christianity, which became dogmatic in the year 325, believed that Jesus was God, that the idea of Trinity. And as I mentioned then, they would duke it out for generations. You know, Christianity is dogmas. Even their core dogmas were voted on, manipulated, right, decided and changed by wars. Right? And we talk core values. What is God? Is Jesus God? Is Jesus not God? It was never decided on immediately. And these were Arian Christians, the Visigoths. Right? Ultimately, the Franks, as I mentioned, would convert a lot of these people around them. Charles Martel, of course, who would be the father of Charlemagne, would really be the pusher of it throughout Europe. But the Visigoths were Arians. When they took over Spain as a whole, immediately anti-Semitic decrees were put into place. Anti-Semitic decrees that no longer was it just separating the Christians, but Jews were restricted from many things in society. It would get worse. Because in 589 of the Common Era, the Visigoth King Richard left the Arian sect and joined the Orthodox Catholic sect of Nicenean Christianity, of Trinity, And of course, that was under the Catholic Church in Rome. And he immediately put all of the Catholic anti-Semitic decrees, which he had discussed previously, into place in Spain. Subsequently, in 612 of the Common Era, at the Council of Toledo, now this is remarkable. If you think, everyone knows of the Spanish Inquisition. Oh, the Spanish Inquisition, 1492, conversion or death, right? That wasn't even that. Then it was conversion, expulsion, or death. In 612, they didn't have a conversion, expulsion, or death. In Spain, in 612, there were much fewer Jews, but the option was given conversion or death. Right? Scourging, mutilation, banishment, and confiscation of goods. Apparently, they had some option to leave, but banishment in those days, this was before Christopher Columbus and ships, it was pretty much, you know, with limited choice. So under this Council of Toledo III, Jews were ordered to convert to Christianity. In 633, already the Fourth Council of Toledo convened to address the problem of crypto-Judaism. Thinking about Murano's 15th century, 16th century, they had crypto-Jews in the 7th century. Those were Jews who converted merely to escape persecution. So the Fourth Council of Toledo opposed compulsory baptism, but it said that if a Christian would marry a Jew, then the kids would be raised Christian. After that, in the year 7 or 9, there was civil war in Spain between the Arian Christians and the Nicene Christians, and the Jews were caught in the crossfire. Now remember when I talked about the coming of Muslims, the mixed bag, the mixed blessing, because at the time Spanish Jewry would have been forcibly assimilated. And I said that what Islam did is it caused a check on Christianity. It forced, it split the world. Well, in 711, just 2 years after the start of this internal Christian war in Spain, and the Jews were already ostensibly, forcibly converted, the Muslims conquer Spain. The Muslims, which were at the time, it was the Moors, which were a mix of Arab and Berbers, and if you don't know the difference between Arab and Berbers, you speak to someone in North Africa, oh, they're very different. If you ask a Moroccan Jew, or a Tunisian Algerian, the Berbers are a different culture, a sect. It's like describing chocolate. You can't really describe them. They're a nomadic people. But you have to see them. They are certainly different than the Arabs, but they were also Muslims. So the Moors were a mix of Berbers and Arabs, all Muslims of course, under General Tariq ibn Zayd. Okay? General Tariq ibn Zayd, he landed in a location called Jabal Tariq, named after him. Jabal Tariq, Mount Tariq, also now known as Gibraltar. Right? Now, the Tariq meaning of course the rock, Gibraltar, Mount Tariq, that's where he lands, and he has his name till his day. Gibraltar is where the Muslims start their conquest of Spain, and of course, as I mentioned, when we talk about the Arabs, they went all the way past the Pyrenees to France, and Charles Martel would force them back in 732, but he quickly conquers Spain. Look at source number two. This is Professor Montgomery Watts, who I quoted at length when talking about Jewry and Islam and the Babylonian Jews. It is a common misapprehension that the holy war, jihad, meant that the Muslims gave their opponents a choice between Islam and the sword. This was sometimes the case, but only when the opponents were polytheists and idol worshippers. For Jews, Christians, and other peoples of the book, there was a third possibility. They might become a protected group, dhimmis, paying a tax or tribute to the Muslims, but enjoying internal autonomy. This was the case during those conquests. Now, we'll see later that the original general moderate position of the Muslims would change over time. But the Jews, when they came in, these crypto-Jews welcomed the Muslims, almost like, you know, when the Americans reconquered parts of Europe, there were flowers to throw at them. The Jews welcomed the Muslims with open arms, so much so that, as the historians say, that the Jews of Toledo were the ones who opened the gates for the Moors to come. I mean, they opened the gates to Toledo to welcome these people. So much so was the Jewish support for these Moorish invaders, you have to imagine a fifth column, that the Moors, as they were advancing, they didn't come with at first huge armies. They kept advancing. They put the Jews in charge of Cordova, Malaga, Granada, Seville, and Toledo for a brief period of time. It was under Jewish authority. I mean, they knew that the Jews would be good allies. That's how enthusiastic the Jews were that the Moors were conquering Spain. They were embracing this with open arms. They were finally free from radical Christian anti-Semites who forcibly converted them, and they were living in secrecy, living in darkness, and here they were redeemed. They were set free. And as we'll see, that under the Moors, Al Andalusia was not only a great place for the Jews, we'll discuss at length, but because of the Jews, especially because of the Jews, it became the most populous, cultured, and industrious land in all of Europe for centuries. The Moorish Spain was the most developed, was the most profitable, was the most powerful part of Europe for a while. Okay? And look at source number three. This is an English historian, Martin Sharp Hume, not a Jew, writing his book, The Spanish People. Side by side with the new rulers lived the Christians and Jews in peace. The latter, rich with commerce and industry, were content to let memory, this is talking to the Jews, the memory of their oppression by the priest-ridden Goths sleep. In other words, the Jews moved on. You know, you always talk about the Jewish people, their success in America. You know, many Holocaust survivors, we never mourn. My own grandparents were Holocaust survivors. They didn't sit and mourn, they rebuilt. And you meet so many Jews today who post-Europe came to America and started over. The Jews didn't sit there and mourn. You see some minorities were afflicted and they're constantly mourning their previous status. They never advance. Jews go out, live. Right? We don't constantly, we live. And that's why when you have secular Jews who have Holocaust Jewry, that's a tragedy. If all of your Jewry is Holocaust Jewry, you know, it kills me. I'm not saying, listen, I grew up with the Holocaust in my blood. You know, I'm named after my two great-grandfathers who were killed in the Holocaust. I go with story after story, but that's not the essence of my Jewry. My Jewry is this world, right now, where I'm living, doing, not just sitting there mourning the past, but doing in the present. And because the Jews did in the present, that's where they're successful. Now, with the Moors, and this division in Europe becomes for the first time the terminology of Sephardic and Ashkenazi. Now the next lecture, we will discuss the house of Rashi, and really the beginning of Ashkenazic Jewry as an entity by itself. But what is the difference between Sephardic Jewry? Because in Spain, Sephard literally means Spain. But we don't refer to Sephardic Jewry as only Spain. What's the difference between Sephardic Jewry and Ashkenazic Jewry, besides the liturgy of prayer? Well, Rabbeinu Bachya, Ibn Pakudya, who we'll discuss for a little bit in a while, he was the dying of Saragossa. He wrote a work called Duties of the Heart, Chovat Levavot, which was actually translated by Judah Ibn Tibbon, who translated Maimonides' works, because he wrote in Arabic, which was the language of the land, and in his Hakdama, in his introduction, he says the difference. This is in the 11th century, defining a Sephardic Jew and an Ashkenazic Jew. He doesn't say it's a Jew who lives in Spain and a Jew who lives in France. It's because there were many Sephardic Jews living in Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria at the time, Babylonia, which is Iraq, and Persia. A Sephardic Jew is a Jew under Muslim dominion. An Ashkenazi Jew with a Jew under Christian dominion. And if you'll notice, all Sephardic Jews come from Muslim countries, and all Ashkenazic Jews come from Christian countries. And we'll see a large part of the differences come from the influences of the surroundings, people around them, and the schools of thought which developed as a result of the culture they lived. But you look wherever you go, Sephardic Jewry would be in Sephardic lands, in the Muslim lands. Ashkenazic Jewry is in Christian lands. And the beginning of Sephardic Jewry, therefore, will be much different, as we learn next week, than Ashkenazic Jewry, because we'll see the Sephardic Jews had a very open society an Ashkenazic Jew starts in the house of Rashi in the dark ages of Christian Europe. These will have ramifications to our very day. That will continue on also. But it's important to note that at this time, that we see the first beginning language of Sephardic and Ashkenazic. Until that point, it was one, everyone was in Babylonia together. There's no real defined Ashkenazic Jewry, and there's no Sephardic Jewry. And by the way, if you look at the prayer books, it's hard to say that either were more correct, okay? They are very similar. It happens to be, on some levels, Ashkenazic Jewry are more closer to the Middle Eastern Jewry, Babylonian Jewry, because ultimately, Sephardic Jewry liturgy today will take a lot of the Kabbalistic things which came much later. When you look at the Siddur of the Rambam, it's not all the Ari's additions. How good was it? Was the golden age of Spain really good? Gold. Was it really great? So no matter what, according to all historians, you can't talk about Spain and North America today in the same dialogue. If you think that Spain was like America or Canada today, it was nothing close. Yes, the Jews were very successful, but Spain still had ingrained anti-Semitism. You were a dhimmi. A Jew was by nature a second-class citizen. There were laws of how a synagogue could be built and how it couldn't be built. In no way, form, or fashion was the golden age of Spain anything comparable to the freedom of religion, the freedom of rights that we have today in America. Now, it happens that proportionally the Jewish success was way out of proportion. They dominated the middle class and were well represented in the upper classes. They were not part of the peasant class. In fact, if you look at Rabbeinu Bachya, in his writings, he writes about the blessings of God. He says, here we are in the exiles, and there are no peasants amongst us. Some in Spanish Jewry. They weren't the peasants. They were either middle class mostly, and some of them were in the upper classes. That's who the Jews were. But there are still many, many rules, government-sanctioned rules, based on Sharia law against them. And you were limited what you can do. Jews live separately. Yet, if you look at historians, for example, Maria Rosa Menocal is a professor at Yale. She wrote a book called The Ornament of the World. And in it, she claims that tolerance was an inherent aspect of Andalusian society. And definitely, the Jewish dhimmis, although they were dhimmis, made the Jews in the Christian lands look persecuted and afflicted. They had tremendous freedoms, tremendous opportunities that the Jews in the Christian Europe did not have, and even Jews in other parts of the Islamic lands did not have. Look at source number 4. This is Bernard Lewis, who is considered by most today the foremost expert on Islamic history. He is a professor emeritus at Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. The claim to tolerance now heard from Muslim apologists, and more especially from apologists from Islam, is also new. It is only very recently that some defenders of Islam have begun to assert that their society in the past accorded equal status to non-Muslims. No such claim is made by spokesmen for resurgent Islam. And historically, there is no doubt that they are right. Traditional Islamic society neither accorded such equality nor pretended that they were doing so. Indeed, in the old order, this would have been regarded not as a merit, but as a dereliction of duty. It would be against the Quran. How could one accord the same treatment to those who follow the true faith and those who willfully reject it? This would be a theological as well as a logical absurdity. What Bernard Lewis is attacking is the Muslims who say, well, if you live in our lands, like the Cordoba Project today, right? Cordoba Project in Manhattan, then what do they say? Look at Cordova. We Muslims, we know how to be tolerant. Now, unquestionably, that's not true. Jews were not equals, and neither were Christians under even the most moderate, tolerant Moorish society. They still were second-class citizens. They still had laws against them. So it says, Bernard Lewis is not saying it wasn't a golden age, relatively speaking. But don't dare say that they were equals. This is not a freedom of religion. There was no freedom of expression. A Jew couldn't say what he wanted to a Muslim. Jew couldn't do what he wanted to a Muslim. A Jew couldn't even go to court against the Muslim, as I mentioned. And they certainly had status as second-class citizens. We'll see that they couldn't dress like Muslims. They couldn't do certain things like Muslims. So to say that they were like Muslims is preposterous. Again, the Jews were economically and intellectually very high classes. Right? They were very successful. But they were limited. Right? They were blocked in to certain things, which, you know, at the same level, you know, I was once reading about Hollywood Jewry, you know, secular, of course, Hollywood Jewry, were very, very successful. But at the same time, they couldn't get their kids into half the private schools in Los Angeles in the 40s, 50s, and 60s because they had no Jews at rules in these schools. You know, whether they were open or covert, the WASPy private schools still didn't want them. Here, they didn't have to be covert. It was open. Yes, you're a successful doctor. Yes, you're a successful lawyer, but you're still a Jew. You still have to dress differently. You still couldn't take advantage of Muslims. There were serious built-in laws. Mark Cohen, who is also a professor at Princeton, he stressed this point as well, but he does also stress that yes, Jews were second-class citizens, but they were much better shaped than anywhere else in the world, and that's why this is called the Golden Age of Spain, and rightly so. Meaning, relative to that world, the world of the Middle Ages, this was as good as it got. Hey, this was as good as it gets. Now, Bruno Lewis then points out that these Jews had a tax called jizya, which we mentioned more than once, and he contends that the tax of jizya was not only an anti-Semitic or anti-Muslim, anyone who was not Muslim, but it was a way of showing that you were subordinated to Muslim society. That no matter who you were, you still had to pay a jizya tax, meant that you're always, by the way, taxes you see even to our day, have ramifications. Right? The jizya tax is a reminder that you are not special. You are a second-class citizen. It's a tax that only non-Muslims paid. What was Jewish life like in Islamic Spain? Well, the Jews actually lived in their own neighborhoods. As a culture as Jews were, and we'll see that the Jews were very, very close, especially with the upper middle class of Spain. Jews were in that society. They had less to do with the peasants of Spain, of Moorish Spain, but they were well-versed and acclimated into the upper class society of Spain, and we'll learn in a couple of weeks from now that that will have ramifications in the future as far as assimilation, serious ramifications as far as assimilation, because they were very, very, very well set up in the society. But the Jews lived in their own walled areas called Al-Jama. They had their own administration, they had their own Bati Dinim, they had private autonomy on Jewish courts, the Rabbanim, the Rajba, the Rosh, the Rivash, the Rif, they were all Rabbanim in Spain, and all of them would adjudicate their own laws. Now this was great for the Jews, because we're obligated by Jewish law, not Gentile law. It's also great for the Muslims. It took their court system a lot, 10-15% of the population, out of their court system. It freed up Islamic courts as well. The influence of Islamic culture was significant. As mentioned, all of the major works were in Arabic, because the Jewish people all spoke Arabic. The language of lectures, the language of study was in Arabic. In certain places they even prayed in Arabic, although that was uncommon. The Jews in Spain would wash their feet and their hands upon going into the synagogue. That's, washing your feet and hands was common in Muslim society. Moreover, if you ever listen to Sephardic music, it sounds very, very similar to Arabic music. A lot of the music, the tunes, came from the Arabs. They dressed like the Arabs, the Moors. If you ever look at Rav Avadia Yosef, all the Sephardic clothing, that was how great Arab dressed. It was a change on it. Jews couldn't wear green and white. Those were Islamic colors. Jews couldn't wear fine clothing such as fur and silks. Right? Can you imagine being the most wealthy Jew? You can't wear fur or silk. It didn't make a difference. Those were garments only for Muslims. But they did follow a lot of the Arab dress. The main center of Jewry Now, you don't see this in Babylonia. You see that yeshivas were. But in Spain already, you see that the main center became the synagogue. There were hundreds of synagogues in Spain. Hundreds. For example, Cordova and Granada, in the 10th century, each had 6,000 Jews. They all had 24 synagogues. Toledo, which had less than 4,000 Jews, had 11. And the synagogues were not just areas of prayer, but like contemporary Bate Knesset, they were places where people met up. They were social centers. They had a social hall, places where people communicated. It was a Jewish bonding place. Moreover, Shabbos in, and this, as I should mention, the synagogues throughout the Muslim countries were very, they had to kind of, zoning laws according to the Muslims. Obviously no figures of humans there. That's like a no-no in Islamic culture. Could be a no-no if it's protruding Jewish culture, Jewish law as well. No figures of humans. They were more plain, more simple. Unlike, you will see the synagogues in Christian Europe, where you had huge cathedrals, which were ornamental and beautiful, so you would have huge Jewish synagogues like the Christians. The Muslims did not tolerate that. You don't find any ancient beautiful synagogues in almost anywhere in the Muslim lands. You don't go to, ancient Babylonia or Iraq and Baghdad and find beautiful synagogues, or in Persia. It wasn't like that. Morocco didn't have big beautiful synagogues. But you do find big beautiful synagogues in France and Germany and countries like that, because that was tolerated and encouraged in those lands. The main center of Jewish study, culture, as I spoke about it 2 weeks ago, at first was Cordova. And that was because of Chistai ben Ibn Shabrut, who I spoke about. And as I mentioned today, Moshe starts a yeshiva in Cordova, and Chistai was the advisor. He was the chief in command in Cordova, as I mentioned. He wrote the letters to the Khazars. The Chistai letters were the letters written from Spain to the Khazar kingdom, which we read at length last time. So at first it starts in Cordova, and the achievements were immense. Not only were the Jews affected by the Muslims, but all of Muslim society was affected by the Jews, and that's what we'll discuss in a minute. But after Cordova, I spoke about Cordova last time, the next great leader, because Chisdai was this amazing leader who supported Menachem ben Saruk and Dunish ben Laprat, as I mentioned, the two great scholars of grammarians and poets who Rashi quotes all the time in his commentary on Chumash, was Shmuel HaNagid. Shmuel ibn Nagarila. Nagarila in, I'm sure my Arabic is off, but Nagarila in Arabic means prince. Shmuel HaNagid, Samuel the prince, was born in 993. Shmuel corresponded with Rav Haigon. Now this is how you see Spain was already on the map with Shmuel HaNagid. Therefore when Rav Haigon dies, Spain is right there. Spain's ready to take its place. Shmuel HaNagid was a student of Rabbi Enoch. Rabbi Enoch, as I mentioned, was the little son of Moshe on the boat. He took over his father's yeshiva in Cordova, and in 1013 there was a civil war in Cordova. That was when Shmuel HaNagid was 20 years old. The Muslims, and we'll see soon, that's how they lost Spain, were constantly fighting amongst themselves. Now, if you fight amongst yourself in Muslim lands, well, you have nothing to worry about, but when they fought in Spain, they were right next to the Christians, and the Christians would conquer them because of their internal fights. In 1013, there was a civil war in Cordova. The Jewish center of Cordova gets wrecked along with the city, and Shmuel HaNagid and his friends all run to Granada, to Malaga in particular. And Shmuel HaNagid ends up being the chief advisor to the visor. And the visor is basically the prime minister of Granada. And the visor answers to the caliph, which is the president, the chief in charge of Granada. And for years he's helping out this visor. Well, one day the visor gets old and he starts getting ready to die. And Caliph Habus, who's the caliph of Granada, which is now the most powerful caliphate in Spain, he tells his visor, "What am I going to do without you? I've had your advice for years. You've been so helpful. What could I do without you?" So he says, "I want you to know all of my advice is because of some Jew named Shmuel. if you put him, you know, he knew who Shmuel was, if you put him in charge, you'll be okay. Shmuel Hanagin, then he gets raised up to be the visor, like kind of like Joseph in Lexus Persia. He ends up being the visor of Granada, which was the most prominent caliphate at the time. And of course, he became the patron of Jews. He himself was a communal rabbi. He was a sponsor of many yeshivas as well. He was the most powerful political Jew in 15th century since Mordechai was in Shushan. Okay, you literally had a Jew in the Gentile kingdom as a number two person in the most powerful Islamic entity, the most powerful part of Europe, Granada at the time, as a number two in charge. And not only was Shmuel Nagin a communal rabbi, a scholar, a supporter of Torah, but he was also a general. They have many, many letters of his war battles. He was a general of the army of the Granada. He was a true Renaissance man at all levels, and he was a brilliant man. As I mentioned, Shmuel Nagid, he published Shmuel ben Chafe's Introduction to the Talmud, what we had of it. Shmuel Hanagid, they bring us a famous story. He was once walking on the street. Now, if you want to see what to be a Jew, he's the number two person in Spain. Number two person probably in the world at some level. Okay, he's a number two, he's an advisor to the Caliph of Granada. And he's walking on the street with the Caliph. And the Muslim merchant opens his mouth to Shmuel Nagin and says, "You Jew!" Now, can you imagine having the chutzpah to do that to the Russian czars in the 19th century? They'd kill you in a second. So, in fact, the Caliph, who had permission, said, "Shmuel, let's have him killed. Shmuel, let's have him killed." So, you have to imagine, even here's the number two, you can still have a Muslim merchant scream out at him something. But Shmuel Nagin told the Caliph, "Give me a week. I want to change the way he talks." A week later, they passed by again, and this Muslim merchant was praising, "You're such a tzaddik, Shmuel, thank you so much for walking by. Could you bless me?" The Caliph looks at Shmuel and said, "What did you put a curse on him? You give him a recantation. I mean, what happened then? Last week he's using foul language. Today he's blessing you." So the famous thing, Shmuel told him, "Not merely have I cut out his bad tongue, but I've given him a good one instead." And then during that week, Shmuel gave him presents. He was friendly with him. And so he told the Caliph, "Anyone you're friendly to and you can win over, it's always better than fighting them and killing them." That was his message to the Caliph. If you want to be successful in life, don't just kill your enemies. Win them over instead. You'll be more successful. Shmuel Hanagid died in the year 1055, but by the time he died, Spain was now the center of Torah. It had left Babylonia, and the center of Torah was now in Spain. He was mourned by Jews and non-Jews, and we'll see what happened a few years after the Granada. Jews excelled in many things in Spain. They were, you look at America today, you can see that to an extent, but not even there, it's even more proportional. I mean, today in America, you see the Jews' dominance in finance, in media, in sciences, in many areas you can see Jewish brilliance around. Well, in those days, you could see Jews excelled in skilled crafts. They were tanners, metal workers, goldsmiths, silversmiths, and jewelers. Some of these things come over to our day. The Jews became diamond cutters. Well, when the Jews left Spain, eventually they ended up, the Muranos, in Amsterdam. Amsterdam, of course, became Antwerp, to this day, became the diamond center. Jews were diamond cutters. Where did they start becoming diamond cutters? In Spain. From that time, we are great diamond cutters. That started in Spain. And then what happens, went to Antwerp, and eventually it spread to New York. I mean, the diamond markets are today. Israel was, for years, the number one diamond polisher country in the world. And that's because that trade has been passed down for generations amongst Jews. Jews excelled in sciences. Many of the most prominent Jews were doctors. Maimonides, Nachmanides, Rabbeinu Nissim of Gorona, Chazda ibn Shaput, they were all doctors. They were all doctors. Some of them were doctors for the heads of the sultans and the caliphs. Jews excelled in trade. As I mentioned before, Jews were the bridge between the Christian world and the Muslim world. They would go and trade. We'll talk about more of that in a future lecture. Jews excelled in scholarship. They excelled in Talmud. The great Talmudists were in Spain. The Ramban, Nachmanides, the Rif, Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, who had to leave North Africa due to a false accusation. It went to Spain because Spain had become the center. The Rajba, the Ritva, all of the great Talmudists were there. The Avram Ibn Ezra, which is one of the great biblical commentators and poets, was in Spain. Rabbeinu Bachya Ibn Pakudya, who wrote The Duties of the Heart, Chovas Lavavos, which I mentioned, to this day, it's a classic. The Stipler, for example, said that a Jew who learned Duties of the Heart sees the world differently. Meaning, a Jew who learned the work and did it, it's a different Jew. A Jew's head's been opened up, you'll see a different tree, you'll see a different sunset, you'll see a different Jewish history. You have a different perspective of the world. It basically, Duties of the Heart is a book, one of the top two or three Musar books ever written, is Duties of the Heart. It's one of the most well-used books. It's a classic. It's translated by Feldheim. If someone has not went through that book, then perhaps we should look at the world a little bit differently. It's a good investment of time. There was Judah Halevi, who perhaps personified the greatest poet, was the heart of Spain. Yehuda Halevi, who some people say was related to the Ibn Ezra, was the famed author of the Kuzari, who I mentioned last lecture, which was based off the story of the Khazars. He was a student of a student of Ichastai's yeshivas, Ichastai's Shabruni. He saw the letters, and he wrote a dialogue between the Khazar king and the Jewish rabbi, and in doing so, he spoke about the theology of Judaism, the passion of Judaism, the viewpoint of Judaism. It's also one of the classic works. This work was written 1,000 years ago. Jews throughout the generations have studied it. Rabbi Yehuda Levi was a man of great charm. He had many friends. He was a poet. He wrote many of the poets, and liturgy comes from Yehuda Halevi, Judah Levi. He's famous for saying, "Though I am in the West, my heart is in the East." And he was West. He was famous. He was West of. He ultimately moves to Israel, follows his dream. In fact, some of the kiddush that we talk about, the love of Israel, that we say on Tisha B'Av, were penned by Judah Halevi. He dies kissing the ground in Israel as an Arab trampled on him with his horse. He kissed the ground, as he kissed the ground and he came to Israel, an Arab trampled down on his horse. That was the wish of Jews. In fact, many of those who are passionate about loving Israel to this very day study the works of the Kuzari, which really is filled with a passion, a love of the land of Israel. Poetry, indeed, became very, very popular amongst the Jews in Spain. That was partially because of Islamic influence. You don't find the same focus on poetry in Christian Europe amongst the Jews. It was in the Spanish countries where, at the time, you had many Muslim poets using the lands. So the Jews kind of showed that we can do one better. If you can do that, then we can do this. And they became really focused on poetry. There was the famous Shlomo Ibn Gabriel. Ibn Gabriel was one of the famous Jewish poets. He wrote 400 poems. He passed away at a young age at 37. Now, in talking about many people, Nachmanides, it's worth it to mention that there was no such thing as a last name. Okay, the reason why we call Maimonides or Nachmanides, we can condense name, there's no such thing as a last name. In fact, Spanish Jewry would only get last names 500 years ago, like Yosef Caro. By his time, he had last names. Until that point, there was no, Maimonides didn't have a last name. The Ramban didn't have a last name. Historically, Jews went by their father's name. Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon is Maimonides. So Maimonides is Maimonides is Rav Moshe ben Maimon. Nachmanides is Rav Nachman, I don't know his father's name. Right? You would have everyone ben. If they were a Kohen, they then Rav Moshe ben David HaKohen. Right? That's how Jews were called throughout the generations. For Ashkenazi Jewry, you don't find last names until almost 250 years ago, when the Christian countries forced names on Jews to take a last name. And that's why you have all these kind of like last names, like a lot of them are colors or flowers, green, green is green, white, bloom, or flowers blooming to flower. You have colors, you had, you know, fields, you had all kinds of, or cities, people took the last name of cities. Even in Spain, Toledano is a famous Jewish Spanish name. Toledano is Toledo. Shapiro, Spires. Right? They took the cities they lived in and used those as last names as well. The Jews were also, as mentioned, heavily involved in trade and commerce, and they were the middle class. They were doctors, politicians, engineers, pharmacists, winemakers, translators, educators, bankers, astronomers, merchants, scientists, farmers, architects, and ambassadors. The Jewish people were the middle class of Spain. They were the professional class of Spain. And in fact, even when the Christians would take over the Iberian Peninsula, for several generations, they depended upon the Jewish people to run these middle classes. As Russian Jewish historian Leon Polakov, making sure, Jews enjoyed great privileges and their communities prospered. There was no legislation or social barriers preventing them from occupations or commercial activities. In other words, even though you were a second class citizen, the unique thing about Spain at the Moorish period is they can do whatever they want. All occupations were open. Many Jews migrated to areas newly conquered by Muslims and established communities there, and they became extremely powerful. How did this golden age end? Well, immediately upon conquering Spain, the Islamic kingdoms started to fight amongst each other. And what they did is, they did a very foolish thing. They broke up to a state system, to a caliph system, but they had no unity. You have to imagine if there were 50 states in the United States of America, and they'd be separate states. Like the United States would take over and all of a sudden split up at the states. So you'd be a lot more vulnerable. You know, Delaware is nice and powerful when it's connected to the United States. If you take Delaware by itself, I think that they can fall to many a country. Hawaii is nice and powerful, but Japan would have taken it over. This was before it was a state. And so what the Christians would end up doing is knocking off Islamic state by state separately. Because they didn't have unity amongst themselves, they fell to the Christian reconquest, the reconquista of Spain. This century's battle started to put a pressure on the Muslims themselves. And the Muslims felt under duress. And because they were under duress, they became less amicable to the Jews. In fact, the first major pogrom in the Muslim world happens in Spain in 1066 in Granada. The son of Shmuel HaNagid, who took over his father's position, was massacred in Granada with 4,000 Jews in one day by the peasants of Granada. And with that, you start to see sporadic attacks of Jews under Muslim Spain. That was because they felt less at heart. Interestingly enough, the Jews themselves, because of this, the Jews who opened the gates of Toledo were the ones who opened the gates of Toledo back for the Christians when they conquered back Toledo. Toledo is one of the first cities of Spain reconquered by the Christians in 1085. So we know that when did Granada fall, the last fort of Spain, the last part of Spain to the Christians? 1492. By 1085, the Christians had conquered Toledo, the great city of Toledo. And the Jews, 40,000 Jews, fought with Alfonso IV of Castile to reconquer Toledo for the Christians. Little did they know what would happen to them in the future. And there were tens of thousands of Jews who fought on the side of the Muslims. So you had Jews on both sides of the fence. But you can see already that it became less comfortable. Part of the reason was that by that time, the Berbers had conquered large parts of Spain. And the Berbers were much less tolerant than the Moorish, the Moors. And it got much worse in 1148 when the Almohads came in. When the Almohads came, you have to imagine the Shah of Iran. Now, if you speak to Iranian Jews, Iran was never a great country for Jews. In the 19th century, they basically forcibly converted Meshad. was always dangerous, but at least it was tolerable. When the Shah would fall, and you'd have Khomeini take his place, well, the world didn't become tolerable. Became, Jews would move to Los Angeles. Jews would move to other places. Well, this was a greater change than Iran falling to Khomeini. Okay? When the Lomads, you can't even imagine the Shah falling down in Khomeini and the Revolutionary Guard of Iran taking in. The coming of the Almohads to Spain was the Khomeini plus. These were Islam always has periods of radicals, okay? They have a constant history of moderates, radicals. It goes back and forth, you know, how seriously they all take the Quran. Well, the Almohads were fanatical Muslims. When they came to Spain, they gave forced conversion or expulsion, and very often they didn't even have a choice of expulsion. They forcibly converted you. We'll learn later in a lecture about Maimonides, that's from the Rambam's family, leave Spain. The Almohads, as we mentioned in our Muslim class, would forcibly convert the whole Fez. Speak to Moroccan Jews, the Fez historically was a great city, 10th century, 9th century, 11th century, but in the 19th century it wasn't. It was a Muslim city. Because all the Jews of Fez were forcibly converted by the Almohads. These, you can't even imagine this is like, basically the equivalent plus of the Revolutionary Guard marching into Spain and taking over Spain. So Jews fled all of the southern and central Iberian Peninsula up to the Christians. And those that were left, many of them were forcibly converted. Eventually, in 1212, the Almohads were taken, were pushed out of it, out of Spain. Many of them were by the Christians, some were by other Moorish groups, but Spanish Jew would never get back, because even when the Muslim parts, you would have restrictions against the Jews, no longer would you have moderate Muslims ruling Spain to the same extent. And in fact, throughout the Arabic world, after the 12th century, it's no longer a moderate Arab world. You find, after even the Granada massacre, the raising of Jewish quarters in other places in North Africa, Egypt, Syria, Yemen, 13th, 14th century, you found Jews no longer being an accepted middle class, but pushed down into second class, being pushed into mellahs, which were essentially ghettos, and Spanish Jewry were never under the Muslims keep their prominence. For a while, under the Christians, because they were needed, they would stay in prominence, but no longer would it ever be. We will discuss in a few weeks from now the Spanish Inquisition and what it was like to be in Christian Spain. The next lecture will be the House of Rashi in the beginning of Ashkenazic Jewry. But in sum, there was a golden age of Spain. There was a golden age which was relative to the time in which Jews were second-class citizens. But since they were always dhimmis, they were never able to totally break that shackle. And as you saw with the Almohads, in 1 second, they could be put at death's throw. So golden it was, but it was always tarnished. Tarnished golden it was. The Spanish golden age was always a time of lack of complete solace. It's where Jews were able to make it, but were never totally accepted. And you would have perhaps the greatest example of that is Judah Halevi, who said, although I am, and he was alive during this, the gildest golden part of the Spanish age, a Jew always has to remember that wherever we are, if we're in the West, our heart is always in the East. Thank you.